This is the Voice of Freedom.
I tell you the truth, no matter who it hurts or helps, even if it hurts me. And oh, how you hate it. Oh, how you hate to hear the truth. Seek ye the truth, and the truth will make you free.
Out of order, I show you out of order. You don't know what out of order is.
You're not just attacking targets. You're bringing a pitiful, helpless giant to its knees.
The peoples of the world today are ready to fight America.
Now the war is going to be here, but we're going to be free.
And I still advocate revolutionary changes in the structure and in the principles that govern the United States. I advocate an end to capitalist exploitation. If that is a crime, then I am totally guilty.
The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America.
These people are psychopathic. They're out to destroy our institutions.
What's up, Hep Cadets, Cats, and Kittens? It's your host, Moxie O'Brien, back again with another episode of Come and See here on another Friday morning in America. And welcome back. It's relatively on time this time, actually. Only like 24 hours late, I think, so I'm getting better at that whole scheduling thing. That's doing well. But today's subject, much like the last couple of episodes that we've had, is really going to focus on a broad history that's sort of led up to where we are today. And as such, there was a lot of reading necessary to get there. But we'll get to that. First, I want to give a shout out to the newest member of the Hep cult, Stuart. Welcome aboard, Stuart. Thank you very much. We appreciate you. If you like what you hear and you would like to become a member of the illustrious and ever-growing Hep cult, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com/comeandseepod, and there are a few different tiers available there with a few different options and rewards available to you. So if you would like to, if you see fit, or you just think I'm cute, help me keep the lights on and feed myself, I would appreciate you ever so much. Along the same lines, we've got the Come and See Coffee. Behold a Dark Roast coming to you here pretty soon. I'm going to have pre-order set up for that within the next week or so. I've got the prototype bag sitting here next to me. It looks fantastic. I love the retro science fiction vibe that we've got going on. Shout out to Black Forge Coffee for that. Very excited about that collaboration, and hopefully that Springboard shirt's being available soon. It's just a matter of me taking enough time to find someone to print them. So those will be coming at you at some point in the near future, and the coffee will be available for pre-order in the next week or so. Having gone through all of the businessy side of things, I'll get back to the show. So today we're going to be talking about white flight in education, as that affects, you know, private schooling, homeschooling, but also the sort of the history of segregation in education leading up to what presaged, if you will, the massive white exodus in education, and also how there's like another one going on right now that we're not really talking much about, but statistics bear out, or is actually just as serious as the one that happened in the 50s and the 60s. So that's interesting, and we'll talk a bit more about that. But it was really weird doing the research for this episode, because we're going to talk about how, in reaction to school desegregation, white people withdrew from public education, sort of set up funds for themselves to build private schools, called all of these private schools Christian and church schools, marketed them under the auspices of, hey, we want to offer private Christian education, and then established the Christian right as sort of a way to launder all of that to the public. And I, as I've mentioned on the show before, I went to one of these schools for several years. So my experience as a black person in one of these schools was profoundly fucking negative. It's worth mentioning that these and, you know, something that I didn't get into in the script that I suppose I could get into now, because I'm not sure where in the God who knows how many fucking pages worth of writing that I did for this episode I would fit in, that, you know, something that I struggle with as a black person, you know, up top is a good place for this, is I've heard arguments from people, you know, throughout history, people like Jim Brown, people like Muhammad Ali, people like Malcolm X, that, you know, if the white man doesn't want you somewhere, why do you feel the need to go there anyway? That if he does not want you in a space, what benefits you being in that space, right? Like, that you should just establish your own space, because why go somewhere where you're not wanted and you're going to be mistreated and disrespected? I kind of understand that perspective, and in a lot of cases, I have that perspective. The problem with education, especially as it's set up in this country, which, if you want to hear more about, we covered the Prussian model of education and No Child Left Behind last season on the show. So you can go back and listen to some of that. I think I did like an hour and 40 minutes on that already. But if you're talking about education, all of the money for all of the funding and all of the districting and everything is come up with by white people. So even if you established black schools, where does the funding come from? Who teaches them? You know, we've also been barred from education at the top levels, which means there's a lot less black teachers available, willing to work for less money, as is typically the case. So it's a de facto segregation problem in many ways, and you don't really have the ability or the material conditions to segregate yourself in education, especially in this country. And so we look at the centuries-long battle that's been had between white people and everybody else, basically, over education. And I think that it's really interesting in the United States when you look at this issue, because it's a lot like what happened before the Reformation with the Catholic Church, in that there is an open recognition. And when I say open, I mean the letters they were writing to their congressmen and shit about why not to allow school integration, and previous to that, black literacy, literally said, point blank, look, if we teach these people, then we can't control them anymore. So it's worth mentioning that in both cases, the ruling class or the ruling body, whether we're talking about white supremacy or the Catholic Church, recognize that letting people educate themselves creates a kind of determinism that makes them a lot harder to control. Even insofar as in both the cases of the pre-Reformation situation in Europe and with slavery in the antebellum South, things were told to the general population, and by general I mean black people here, about what was in the Bible that justified the things that the ruling class was doing to you. You know, we had slave Bibles, Negro Bibles here, and they had things like plenary indulgences before the Reformation. So there's a really weird parallel between what the Catholic Church was doing in Europe before the Protestant Reformation and what white people did to the black population throughout the history of the United States in the denial of determinism through financial means, through access to education, through the ability to establish your own utility services and things of that nature. All of that. And whenever we finally got to the point where the federal government kind of forced the hand of the white ruling class, like, all right, we kind of have to stop doing what we're doing. Well, then the answer was, we're just not going to play anymore. And they established separate institutions and funneled all of the money into those over time. So what you have now is the same system that you had before Brown v. Board of Education, just in a different... We've arrived at the same conclusion in a different way, if you will. And today's episode is going to outline that for you in somewhat exhaustive detail. So I feel like I've already wasted a lot of time up top, kind of for some reason, outlining everything I'm going to talk about for the next like 60 to 90 minutes. But let's get into it. Here we go. In order to set the table for a conversation about school desegregation, we should really start with a conversation about school segregation. Initially, Black Americans weren't even allowed to learn to read legally. Slaves were forbidden from reading or self-educating, and Black schools didn't exist in earnest until 1860, and then only for freemen. Proponents for anti-literacy laws argued openly that literate Blacks were dangerous, in part due to a belief that a literate slave who had the ability to write could conceivably forge documentation to free themselves and then move freely about the country, as well as fears of organization and uprising. After all, Nat Turner was literate, for example, and white people fucking poured over what made Turner decide to kill slave owners, because white people are excellent problem solvers. To date, the United States is the only country ever known to have implemented anti-literacy laws. Ever. Between 1740 and 1834, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, both Carolinas, and Virginia all had anti-literacy laws on record. South Carolina was the first, amending its 1739 Negro Act to make teaching slaves to read or write punishable by 6 months in prison and a fine of £100. Louisiana, North Carolina, and Georgia added floggings to their versions of the punishment, and in Georgia, Black people were legally prohibited from applying for jobs that involved reading. Missouri specifically forbade organizing groups of Black people to educate them. In Mississippi, teaching a slave to read carried a mandatory sentence of 1 year in prison. In Virginia, any group of Black people gathered together for education was declared an unlawful assembly. Accounts from former slaves of having their index fingers cut off for learning to read, for learning to write, and various other punitive disfigurements for the crime of learning are also recorded. The North had its own form of anti-literacy laws. Black students, for example, were barred from public schools, and thus several typically Quaker-founded Black schools began to appear in New Hampshire. The first real attempts at integrated schooling were met with extreme violence. In 1835, the Noyes Academy opened in Canaan, New Hampshire, near Dartmouth College, as a racially integrated school that also admitted women. The president of the academy, Nathan Lord, was at the time the only seated New England college president who admitted Black students to his college. Noyes was the direct result of a failed attempt to found a Black college and a new approach to admit Black students to pre-existing white schools, with the idea of Black preparatory schools to prepare Black students for colleges later. Members of the New Hampshire Anti-Slavery Society endorsed the academy, which was spearheaded by John H. Noyes, as well as attorney George Kimball and Samuel Edmund Sewell. The school was announced in an issue of the abolitionist magazine The Liberator on February 28, 1835, and the formal opening occurred the following month. The white students were mostly local, but the black students were brought in on stage coaches and steamboats from southern states and places like Philadelphia. The original student body consisted of 28 white students and 17 black, some future prominent abolitionists, in fact. Residents of the town objected to black students living in the area, and a local campaign was launched warning of the possibilities of interracial marriage and the town being overrun by southern Negroes and mixed babies. The school was in fact demonized as a brothel where black men were shipped in from the South to impregnate local white girls. And obviously it worked. On July 31st, 1835, the town of Canaan voted to remove the school. This is a quote from the minutes of that meeting. Quote, "The superintending committee appointed by said town proceeding at 7 a.m. August 10th to discharge their duty, the performance of which they believe the interest of the town, the honor of the state, and the good of the whole community, both black and white, required without delay. At an early hour, the people of this town and of the neighboring towns assembled, full of the spirit of 75, to the number of about 300, with between 90 and 100 yoke of oxen, and with all necessary materials for the completion of the undertaking. Many of the most respectable and wealthy farmers of this and the adjacent towns rendered their assistance on this occasion. The work was commenced and carried on with very little noise, considering the number engaged, until the building was safely landed on the common near the Baptist meeting house, where it stands, the monument of the folly of those living spirits who are struggling to destroy what our fathers have gained." End quote. And so the town formed a mob, which destroyed the building, which was later burned down. The black students and the headmaster were run out of town. John Noyes later opened the Oneida Institute in New York, which was the first college to admit white and black students on equal terms. The whites-only Canaan Union Academy was built on the site where the Noyes Academy had previously stood. There was an earlier attempt at black education called the Canterbury Female Boarding School in Canterbury, Connecticut, which operated from 1831 to 1834. Initially conceived as an integrated school, after opposition to the idea of integrated education, the school's founder, Prudence Crandall, opted to only enroll black girls, making Canterbury the first black girls' school in the United States. The school received national attention when the state of Connecticut passed a law against it, and Prudence Crandall was arrested. The subsequent case, Crandall v. State, is considered the first civil rights case in the history of the American courts. It actually predates Dred Scott by like 20 years. The school first opened in November of 1831, and for its first year as a white school, it enjoyed the support of the community. Canterbury curriculum included reading, writing, arithmetic, grammar, geography, history, chemistry, astronomy, and moral philosophy. Tuition, room, and board was $25, the modern equivalent of which would be about $640. That was per quarter. Students could pay extra for instruction in drawing, painting, piano, and French. By the end of its first year, the school reached its capacity of 24 students. Crandall's servant, Mariah Davis, was engaged to a man named Charles Harris, who was the son of the local agent for the Liberator. Crandall began reading the magazine, and she became sympathetic to abolitionism and decided to enroll Harris and Davis's daughter, Sarah, into the Canterbury Academy. She claimed that she had consulted her Bible and decided that it was right to educate black students as well as white ones. Cool that God told you that was okay. Crandall enrolled Sarah Harris as a day student, making Canterbury the first integrated school in American history. Opposition from the town was, of course, immediate, but Crandall was a stubborn and resolute woman. Allegedly, her rebuttal to concerns over integration and race mixing was, and I'm quoting, "Moses had a black wife." Her resistance to the criticism and attempts to have Sarah Harris removed from the school resulted in many white families threatening to withdraw. To this, Crandall responded by closing the school and rebranding it as an exclusively black one. The town, naturally, lost its fucking mind. Fears of an established black colony where, quote, no white woman will be safe, degenerated quickly into violence and vandalism. At that time, Connecticut had one of the largest black populations in the North, and very suddenly, proximity to too many Negroes was an acute fear for the white population of Windham County. Anti-abolitionist riots broke out over the school, and Crandall at one point offered to move the school elsewhere, but she was told that a school for black girls wouldn't be appropriate anywhere. Despite this, Crandall enrolled 17 students and resumed her activities as an educator. Enrollment rose from 17 to 24, with girls traveling from Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New York, and Pennsylvania to attend. On May 24, 1833, the Connecticut General Assembly passed a black law prohibiting the education of black students from outside of the state of Connecticut without express permission from the town where the school was located. The chief proponent of that legislation was the next door neighbor to the school, Andrew Judson. After the law was passed, harassment and assault on the students began. Local physicians also then refused to treat the students. Several of their wagons were tampered with, and some of them almost died in wagon crashes. Crandall's trial for refusing to stop teaching black students from outside the state began on August 23rd, 1833. The jury was unable to reach a verdict, and so a second trial before the Connecticut Supreme Court was scheduled, in which Crandall was quickly found guilty. An appeal was immediately filed and argued before the Court of Errors on July 22, 1834. This time, the court came to no decision, and Crandall resumed operation of the school. She briefly considered relocating to Philadelphia, but was discouraged by anti-black violence in the area. Upon resuming operation, the school was vandalized and a mob attempted, at first unsuccessfully, to burn it down. On September 9th, an armed mob broke into the school and attacked the students. Afraid for the safety of the girls, Crandall closed the school and left the state, expressing shame and disappointment in the town of Canterbury and in the state of Connecticut. The end of the Civil War saw the creation of black schools, which were racially segregated schools that began to appear during Reconstruction. After Reconstruction was ended in 1877, black schools continued with significantly lower funding from now all white state governments. Some of the first black schools were the African Free School in New York and the ABL Smith School in Boston. There were also schools sponsored by the Catholic Church, like St. Francis Academy in Baltimore and the St. Mary's Academy in New Orleans. Black schools from the very beginning had less teachers, less books, and larger class sizes. Teachers made less money, and in some cases, like the Station 1 school, the buildings weren't even up to code. Station 1 was located in Chairs, Florida, in 1870. Originally, Station 1 was a white school. By 1928, Station 1 was deemed, quote, no longer suitable for the needs of the district. At that point, the roof needed replaced and the building flooded during rain periods. There was also no indoor plumbing. So the district built the chair school, which had a heating system, electricity, and a fresh well, as well as new desks, chairs, and indoor plumbing. And they sent the white students of Station 1 to the new facility. It was reported then that Station 1 was closed. It wasn't. It's at this point that Station 1 became a black school. And it didn't receive funding for indoor plumbing until 1950. And overcrowding caused warnings of imminent closure until Station 1 merged with two other schools in 1968, roughly 40 years after white people determined that the building was unsuitable for children. These kinds of educational disparities really first came to a head in the 1890s with the Plessy v. Ferguson case. The basis of the case began in 1892 when Homer Plessy, who was mixed, he was, the term used to be octoroon, it means that he was one-eighth black, boarded a whites-only train in New Orleans. Louisiana had passed a separate car act in 1890, which required equal but separate accommodations for white and non-white passengers. After the failure of Reconstruction, laws like this appeared all over the fucking country, as states reconsidered what equal rights meant now that the federal troops had withdrawn and there wasn't anybody making them. Violation of the Separate Car Act could result in a $25 fine or 20 days jail time. At his trial, Plessy's lawyers argued that the law was unconstitutional. The judge, John Howard Ferguson, denied the request, and ultimately the Louisiana Supreme Court upheld Ferguson's ruling. Plessy then appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, who ruled 7-1 against him, ruling that segregation laws did not violate the 14th Amendment. The Supreme Court ruled that while the 14th Amendment established legal equality, it did not and could not require the elimination of all distinctions based on color. While considered by many to be one of the worst decisions in Supreme Court history, the ruling has to date never been explicitly overturned. Technically, Brown v. Board of Education weakened the Plessy ruling, but it did not overturn it. The Plessy decision effectively legitimized segregation and paved the road for more segregation laws to come. Combined with an 1875 Supreme Court ruling that limited the federal government's ability to intervene in state affairs, which basically made sure that Congress couldn't do much besides intervene in cases of direct discrimination, and granted state legislative immunity, basically, provided the segregation remained, quote, separate but equal, really created the pathway for Jim Crow. Plessy v. Ferguson effectively provided the legal framework for that whole thing, and most southern states subsequently passed new constitutions or amended their previous constitutions to codify black disenfranchisement through literacy tests, poll taxes, white primaries, which were exactly what the fuck they sound like, and grandfather clauses, meaning that old laws could be, quote, grandfathered in. Plessy then changed his plea to guilty and paid the fine. Oh, he was posthumously pardoned in January of last year. So it only took 126 years for that. Plessy v. Ferguson actually holds a distinction in U.S. legal history known as anti-canon, which means in hindsight, almost no one agrees with the decision. We've talked about a few of these on the show. Buck v. Bell, Dred Scott v. Sanford, Korematsu v. United States, and Lochner v. New York all also hold the distinction of being anti-canon. Of course, everyone agreeing that they were wrong didn't help anyone at the time, and I don't know, perhaps we should abolish the fucking Supreme Court. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe it's a really bad idea to give 9 weird people who the general public has no say in the appointment of the ability to unilaterally make decisions that affect millions of people for decades at a time. Especially if, oh, I don't know, in the example of the Supreme Court currently, like 2 out of the 9 of them have affiliations with cults. Maybe that's not a great thing. I also find the name anti-canon cute, as if it's sort of a general acceptance that, well, we don't like to not accept that there was a point at which one of our major institutions unanimously agreed that people didn't get to be people if their state told them that they weren't people. And also, while I'm taking a second to yell about stuff, do you see sort of a theme between, like, the Civil War and desegregation and schooling and all of these other things, where every time the conversation related to states' rights comes up, it's about states' rights to not let black people have rights? And in no other context does the conversation of states' rights ever the fuck come up. It is literally only ever about, my state should have the right to own these people, though. Or, well, my state should have the right to tell these people they can't read. Or, my state should have the right to tell these people that they can and can't fuck people. Or, my state should have... What the fuck? Like, it's all just your state's rights to suppress the rights of a portion of the citizenry of your state. And in so doing, I think that we are at cross purposes in that your support of, I will see your support of states' rights and say, I don't really recognize the authority of any government at all whatsoever, so it doesn't really matter what the state tells me I can and can't do. That's kind of how I feel, but I don't know, I've been called a lot of things. I'll get back to the script. Some states, like Virginia, had already passed compulsory education laws, so children of all races were still required to go to a school. The similarities fairly ended there, and the quality of black education during Jim Crow can only be described as deplorable. By 1900, for example, in Virginia, black schools averaged 37% more students. A study from the Virginia Historical Society shows that by 1938, the average property value of a white school in the state was $561,262, compared to $176,881,000 for black schools. That's a difference in property value of $384,000. Campaigns by the NAACP to improve the quality of black schools were met with hostility from white people, and over the following 3 decades, educational disparity continued to widen. According to studies conducted by the NAACP in the late 1920s, the state of Georgia spent $4.59 per year on each African American child, compared to $36.29 for white children. So, about 9 times as much. Rethinking Schools found, which is an organization, found in a 2004 study that by the end of the 1930s, only 19% of African American children between the ages of 14 and 17 were enrolled in high school. Some alternatives, such as Septima Clark's Citizenship Schools and the SNCC's Freedom Schools, attempted to give black children better education, but the disparity in funding and materials, combined with white opposition to the very idea of black children being taught well, kept things fairly separate and far from fucking equal. This came to a head in yet another Supreme Court case, Brown v. Board of Education. The underlying case began in 1951, when the public school system in Topeka, Kansas, refused to enroll Oliver Brown's daughter in the elementary school that was closest to the family's home, instead requiring she take a segregated bus to a black school further away. The Browns and 12 other black families filed a class action lawsuit in federal court against the Topeka Board of Education on the grounds that its segregation policy was unconstitutional. initially a special three-judge court of the U.S. District Court for the District of Kansas ruled against the Browns, relying on the precedent of Plessy v. Ferguson. And, of course, the separate but equal ruling held in that at that level. The Browns and their chief counsel, Thurgood Marshall, appealed the decision to the Supreme Court, who issued a unanimous 9-0 decision that separate but equal educational facilities were inherently unequal and that laws that impose separate but equal education violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Granted, neither this decision nor its follow-up, Brown 2, provided any instruction on how to end school segregation, just that schools must desegregate. So a system that was designed to separate white and black students legally was abolished. None of the additional systemic controls were removed, and the states who didn't want to integrate were told to figure it the fuck out and do it quickly. And pushback, obviously, came very, very swiftly. The massive resistance was a strategy concocted by Senator Harry Byrd Sr. of Virginia. Byrd founded the Byrd Foundation as a network of politicians and judges meant to control Virginia's political process and maintain segregation. One of the ways that they did this was by cutting all of the funding to integrated schools, and in some cases, closing down entire school districts. Byrd's organization established a firm foothold in rural Virginia. One of his strongest supporters, Benjamin Mews, was a Virginia State Senator before becoming a columnist for the Washington Post. In 1951, the Declaration of Constitutional Principles, or the Southern Manifesto, was drafted. It was signed by 19 U.S. senators and 82 state representatives, including the entire congressional delegations from Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, Virginia, and most of Florida, Texas, and Tennessee. 99 of the signees were Southern Democrats from former Confederate states. The manifesto was written in conjunction with Byrd's massive resistance as a counter to Brown v. Board of Education and presented during the 84th U.S. Congress. The final draft had to be toned down, which is saying something, by J. William Fulbright. No, yeah. That J. William Fulbright, the guy who created Fulbright scholarships, also signed this document and opposed school desegregation. If you think that's fucked up, wait till you learn about Rhodes Scholars. Anyway, the fight against desegregation was, in a familiar turn, framed as a states' rights issue. It involves government overreach in states' rights about education. And like I said, these always seem to conveniently coincide with things curtailing white supremacy. The Southern Manifesto accused the Supreme Court of abuse of power, calling the decision a violation of the 10th Amendment. And some of the strongest opposition in the Senate came from Strom Thurmond, who actually wrote the manifesto's initial draft, the one they had to tone down. There's actually some pretty interesting quotes from the initial draft of the Southern Manifesto here, such as, quote, "The unwarranted decision of the Supreme Court in the public school cases is now bearing the fruit always produced when men substitute naked power for established law," end quote. And another, "This unwarranted exercise of power by the court, contrary to the Constitution, is creating chaos and confusion in the states principally affected. It is destroying the amicable relations between the white and Negro races that have been created through 90 years of patient effort by the good people of both races." I'm sorry. It's just knowing that Strom Thurmond considered Jim Crow 90 years of patient effort between white and black people towards equal. I'm glad you're dead. What can I say? I'll go on. It has planted hatred and suspicion where there has been heretofore friendship and understanding. And I'll give you one more to grow on. Quote, the original Constitution does not mention education. Neither does the 14th Amendment nor any other amendment. The debates preceding the submission of the 14th Amendment clearly show that there was no intent that it should affect the system of education maintained by the states. Strom Thurmond, everybody. I believe the guy who filibustered for a solid 24 hours to try to stop a ruling on the Civil Rights Act or something. So, you know, again, kind of glad you're dead, bud. I'll go on. Following the Southern Manifesto was the Stanley Plan, which was a package of 13 statutes adopted in September 1957 in Virginia, named for Governor Thomas Bonson Stanley. The frenzy over the Brown ruling quite literally nearly destroyed public education, and the Stanley Plan served to drive the nail in deeper. This plan built on guidelines that were established by the Gray Commission, which was another of Byrd's massive resistance players. The original six guidelines were as follows. Number one, cutting off state funds to any integrated school districts. Number two, allowing local referendums to veto the appropriation of local funds for integration. Number three, repeal of state laws allowing school districts to be sued. Number four, allowing states to invoke police power to prevent integration on the grounds that integration would cause civil unrest. Number five, enacting a pupil assignment plan to be implemented solely by the governor. Or number six, enacting a pupil assignment plan to be implemented solely by the General Assembly. After about a month of deliberation, a five-month plan was agreed upon. Number one, no public school integration would be tolerated in Virginia. Number two, school districts that integrated would lose all funding. Number three, the state law permitting school districts to be sued would be repealed. Number four, the power to assign students would be taken away from school boards and given to the governor. And number five, the governor would be granted authority to close any integrated school districts. It's interesting to me how these men would rather not educate anyone at all than educate black and white children together. It's almost like white kids were learning things that black kids weren't supposed to know, or white supremacy, like I said before, much like the Catholic Church before the Reformation, understood that the loss of control happens when you start letting people learn stuff. I don't know, whatever. The Stanley Plan was signed into law after some reforms, and the final enacted version of the Stanley Plan that established the following. Quote, pupil assignment to maintain racially segregated schools. Pupil assignment was no longer a local matter under the new legislation. Pupil assignment was now under the authority of a state-level three-member pupil assignment board whose members were appointed by the governor. The state board made assignments on the basis of race as well as a wide range of other factors, including sociological, psychological, and like intangible social scientific factors, as will prevent, as nearly as possible, a condition of socioeconomic class consciousness among pupils. End quote. Appeals of pupil assignment were made directly to the governor. Students and their parents were required to appeal the governor's decision through the state courts before seeking to move the appeal to the federal courts. Number two, automatic closure of public schools which racially integrate. The legislation required that any school which integrated voluntarily or not must be immediately and automatically shut down. However, the governor was given the discretion to take over integrated schools and reopen the schools on a segregated basis rather than closing the entire district. Integrated schools did not have to stay closed, however. A school district could petition the governor to take over one or more schools or the entire district that had closed and reopened them as segregated schools. Whether exercising his discretion or acting on a petition from the school district, the governor was authorized to act only as an agent of the assembly. The governor was also required to try to persuade the African-American children to return to their racially segregated schools so that the schools could reopen on a segregated basis. In other words, blame the kids for the fact that the school isn't open and suggest that everybody would be happier if they just went back to their old schools. Number three, state reassignment and reopening of public schools. If the governor was unsuccessful in persuading African-American children to return to their racially segregated schools, the governor was authorized to reassign the student to a racially segregated all-black school. At any time, however, a school district could request for the governor that the governor stop administering the local public schools. However, if the schools reopened on an integrated basis, all state funding would be cut off. Number four, funding cutoff. The cutoff of state funding occurred if a school district exercised the local option. The governor had no discretion in this area. The Virginia Constitution required that the state operate efficient public schools, and the legislature had defined efficient to mean segregated. The funds cutoff was automatic, not discretionary. However, funds could be cut off only to integrated elementary or secondary schools or the entire school district as warranted. And finally, tuition grants. School districts were required to offer tuition grants to all students in closed schools. Where schools were integrated, the school district was also required to offer a tuition grant to any pupil who objected to being educated in an integrated school. The amount of the grant was unclear. One bill passed in the final hours of the special session limited the grant to $350 a semester, while another required the grant to be the average amount each school district spent per pupil. Funds for the tuition grants were to come from any withheld state school funds, as well as local funds. Oddly, there was no restriction on the use of the grants, other than that they be used for non-sectarian education. This meant a tuition grant could be used to attend an integrated school. Now, pay attention to that last bit about tuition grants, because in practice, the Stanley Plan created what were known as segregation academies, private all-white schools. Segregation academies, as noted by a 1972 report by the ERIC, can usually be identified as Christian or church schools, which will be relevant in a few minutes, and those schools are overwhelmingly Protestant. These schools typically establish themselves as wishing to provide a Christian education as a guise to avoid enrolling students in integrated schools, and also as a ploy for tax exemption, which is how the establishment of the Christian right really plays into this whole thing in terms of Christian all-white private schools. In May, on May 1st, 1969, a group of black families in Holmes County, Mississippi, sued the Treasury Department to block three new whites-only K-12 private academies from securing tax-exempt status, arguing that their discriminatory policies prevented them from being considered charitable institutions. The schools were founded in response to desegregation, the first year of which saw white enrollment in public schools drop from 771 to 28 in Holmes County, and the following year from 28 to zero. In Green v. Kennedy, it was decided that segregation academies couldn't hold tax-exempt status, a decision that was backed the following year by the Nixon administration. Enter Paul Weyrich. You'll remember him from a few episodes ago. Weyrich saw an opportunity to galvanize conservative support behind a culture war. He latched on to the Green v. Connolly. Connolly was the new head of the Treasury Department by the end of the trial ruling, and saw that the the ruling saw that the government pulling tax-exempt status from church schools, which is something that evangelical leaders could be organized against. In fact, Jerry Falwell's own Lynchburg Christian School stood to lose funding over its racial policies. Another that we've discussed in the past, Bob Jones University in South Carolina, particularly refused to integrate. You see, Bob Jones Jr., the guy who founded the college, believed that segregation was mandated in the Bible, and he formed a coalition with Falwell and Weyrich in defense of school segregation. School desegregation was framed by this group, the proto-Christian right, as an attempt by the government to tell churches what they could and couldn't do. In reality, the IRS was going to force them to start paying taxes, but that doesn't sound nearly as good as the government is trying to tell the house of God what to do. So, there you have it. Weyrich and Falwell led a campaign amongst evangelical leaders blaming Jimmy Carter for allowing the IRS to attack the church. The fact that Nixon had mandated the policy, of course, seemed irrelevant. Weyrich and Falwell saw promise in the organizational and political potential in white evangelicals demonstrated in their serious and voracious opposition to school desegregation, and they prepped to use this to push a Christian conservative Republican into the White House, ultimately settling on Ronald Reagan. In the intervening years, history is rewritten to exclude Weyrich and Falwell's involvement in this, but the record stands. The Roe v. Wade decision allowed their base to expand beyond race and built a political stronghold for conservatives that effectively locked Democrats out of the presidency until the 1990s, when the neoliberal law and order post-Reagan sect of Democrats like the Clintons, Joe Biden, and Barack Obama were finally able to break the cycle by shifting the Democratic Party so far to the right that it was basically the Republican Party of the Nixon administration. With the help and mobilization of a white evangelical Christian base, between 1954 and 1964, Southern legislatures enacted over 450 laws attempting to block integration. And from 1964 to 1975, an estimated 500,000 white students were withdrawn from public schools to avoid integrated schooling. As funds were cut for public integrated schools, grants, vouchers, and funds were established to create more private, unintegrated ones. So white students in districts with no public schools, as I said, in many cases, integrated schools lost all of their funding and districts were shut down, but those students still existed. So they created new private segregated schools and established grants, vouchers, and financial awards that just happened to only go to the white kids to be able to go to them. Now, it's worth mentioning that there were attempts to try to stop this process through busing, like Runyon v. McCrory in 1976, and another, the landmark case, really, Swan v. Charlotte Mecklenburg, Board of Education, which was a case dealing with desegregated busing to promote school integration in 1971. The ruling challenged the deliberate assignment policy that was presented in Byrd's Massive Resistance, allowing for black students to be bused into white districts in an attempt to force integration. The ruling was based on the interpretation that Brown v. Board of Education was an order to integrate and that proactive integration methods must be implemented to ensure equality of access to education. The implementation of integrated busing caused the first signs of white flight, we'll get to it, and the first attempts at blockbusting and redistricting. If you want to hear more about blockbusting, redistricting, redlining, and things like that, I'm actually going to direct you to two episodes of my old podcast, The Four-Cornered Room, where we discussed HOAs in The Myth of Meritocracy Part 2, and also where we discuss block listing and redistricting along racial bases, particularly in the establishment of California and Los Angeles, in an episode about the Watts riots. So if you're curious to learn more about those things, I'm going to direct you there. In addition to housing covenants and HOAs, blockbusting, redlining, etc., sundown towns also made sure that no black families entered many rural white districts, upholding the new legal de facto segregation. It was believed that foregoing districts to force school integration would solve this, but ultimately it underestimated the desire to maintain segregated education. The new laws basically meant that segregation needed to take new forms and new names, but it didn't really go anywhere. That's what de facto segregation is. Legislation that doesn't overtly segregate students, but allows for the process of segregation to continue. De facto. By fact, as opposed to de jure, by law. De facto segregation is housing, banking, and other forms of discrimination that maintain the racial hierarchy while telling everyone that Jim Crow is gone. Gentrification is another great example of this. The expression, "there goes the neighborhood," comes from white people in the 70s who saw integrated neighborhoods and schools as a symbol of social decline, and of course, drops in property value reflected that. After decades of white flight out of the cities, gentrification sees these people's grandchildren moving back in with generational wealth and education and terraforming black neighborhoods into spaces we can't afford to live in anymore. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me back up. I was talking about busing. So, these attempts at busing resulted in many cases in black families being forced to relocate to areas that had schools available, leading to a new geographical segregation imposed by school districts that, of course, alters regional voting demographics and concentrates black citizens in areas where black education is available, thus, again, overcrowding and resegregating education. Even following court rulings forcing private schools to admit non-white students in the 1970s, like Runyon v. McCrory in 1976, by 2021, statistics show that 75% of private school students are white. By 1980, private school enrollment in the South represented 25% of private school enrollment nationwide. In the 11 states that formed the Confederacy, between 675 and 750,000 white students enrolled in private schools, with 90% or higher in unintegrated student bodies. Most black students up to today receive public schooling, which faces chronic funding problems, partly due to fund siphoning to private schools, a practice most states are still engaging in today, due to something that's called school choice. It's de facto segregation. And it's ongoing. As recently as 2017, counties in Alabama, Florida, and South Carolina were voting to secede from their school districts and pull their funding to start new districts carved out along white and higher socioeconomic borders. These are called splinter districts. They're basically gerrymandering for schools. In Ohio's Hunting Valley, for example, which is the wealthiest community in the state with a population of less than 700, they established a splinter district and avoided a collective $3 million in taxes that would have gone to the area's school district. So the more affluent portions of a school district are able to, using their own funds, withdraw from an existing school district and start their own, taking their tax money with them. According to the Civil Rights Project at Harvard University, school desegregation actually peaked in 1988, and school redistricting and a massive increase in homeschooling has created what's being called a resegregated educational environment. By 2005, the proportion of black students in majority white schools was the lowest recorded since 1968. And this rapid exodus of white people from these integrated districts is called white flight. Massive numbers of white families left urban areas like Cleveland, Oakland, Detroit, Kansas City, and Chicago in the 50s and 60s. And while attempts to mitigate this via busing black students into white districts were attempted, this was often met with violence. You'll remember, if you listened to the first season of the show, Pastor Bob, the Klanarchist, and his attempts to blow up buses with black kids on them. And of course, we talked about redlining and HOAs, which help restrict housing integration, which in turn restricts school integration. Again, de facto segregation. These forms of suburbanization and urban decentralization are what's referred to as environmental racism. And to better explain this, I have a Vox article here that I'm going to quote from for you now. This piece is from July 27th of 2017, and it was written by Alvin Chang. Quote, 5 years ago, organizers in Gardendale, Alabama, decided it was time to secede from the Jefferson County School District because of the changing, quote, dynamics. But the simple idea has historically caused a contentious debate about race, class, and education in America. And when the courts ruled on this issue, it resulted in the biggest setback to school integration since Brown v. Board of Education, a legal decision that allows parents to use borders to segregate their kids away from their less desirable peers. The organizers never made overt racial arguments, but they were reacting to a system set up by a 1971 desegregation order to create more racial balance. They said their schools were already overcrowded and underfunded, so why should they bus in other kids who weren't part of their communities? On a Facebook page to discuss the school district's secession, one of the organizers wrote that it would give them, quote, better control over the geographic composition of the student body, end quote. They were hinting at their dismay that students from a mostly black neighborhood were being bused to their mostly white schools. Quote, those students do not contribute financially, one organizer wrote. Quote, they consume the resources of our schools, our teachers, and our resident students, then go home. End quote. The organizer also wrote, quote, a look around at our community sporting events, our churches, are great snapshots of our community. A look into our schools, and you'll see something totally different. End quote. Here's what they hinted at. What everyone knew, but was never articulated. They were carving out a more affluent, more white area and starting their own school district with it. Eight other communities had previously seceded from the Jefferson County School District, all for very similar reasons. They didn't want to be subject to racial integration orders that involved busing, and they didn't want to share tax dollars with people with less money than them. In the South, most school districts are drawn along county borders. But these county borders are also divided up in such a way that the most affluent communities are separated out from less affluent, or if you'd rather, less white communities. And that's not just in Jefferson County. Since the year 2000, 70 other communities have tried to secede from their districts, according to a recent report by EdBuild. Two-thirds of those secession attempts have been successful, and most of the other cases are still ongoing. Sebelia points out that some of these secession efforts are logical, like the one in California's San Fernando Valley. But many of the proposed school borders are along socioeconomic lines, and they would further isolate poor children into segregated schools. This is perhaps the most brazen modern example of privileged groups using borders to separate themselves from other people. quote, "It's a more concrete example of the Make America Great Again ethos," said Erica Wilson, a law professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, who has written extensively on the topic. Quote, "I call it a form of destructive localism. People who are fortunate enough to form utopias do so on the backs of other folks who have been excluded." End quote. But this isn't just a failure of people, of their unwillingness to honor a social contract with a larger community regardless of their fortunes. It's also a failure of the courts and our state legislatures. They've created a system that incentivizes middle-class people to use their moderate wealth to wall in opportunities for their own kids while depriving the children of others. They've allowed parents acting in self-interest to create school systems that reproduce or even exacerbate the structural inequalities we see today. In the 1940s, the federal government started backing home loans to white people but refused them to black people, and even those who wanted to live around black people. This created segregated city neighborhoods. This is commonly repeated when talking about residential segregation, but in his new book, The Color of Law, Richard Rothstein points out that the feds also backed development loans for suburban communities as long as none of the homes were sold to black people, and this created segregated white suburbs. So by the time the Supreme Court integrated schools in the 1954 case Brown v. Board of Education, white families who didn't want their kids to go to school with black children had a very clear opt-out choice, the suburbs, and many of them took that option. Quote, "How might a group deploy boundaries and the law and policy around that to remove themselves from having to share their resources from disfavored others?" This is a question from LSU law professor Chris Tyson. Quote, "That is the story of suburbanization." Tyson, who has written extensively on this topic, says we take urban sprawl as a rational choice by individuals who desire bigger houses, car dependence, strip malls, and highways, but that ignores the government policies that prop up these decisions. Fast forward a few generations, and we now have good schools that tend to be in the suburbs and bad schools that tend to be in the central cities, and they track along racial lines. Tyson says it's easy to think that this is the way things are supposed to be without tracing it back to its racist roots. And even in the cities, white families are able to segregate themselves using borders. For example, the Detroit School Board split attendance zones into a north and south zone, even though they knew it would further segregate schools. So in order to tear down these segregating walls, we need a legal tool to help implement meaningful integration. This tool needed to make sure white families couldn't merely move to the other side of a border or create new borders to opt out of a social contract with white people who are far less fortunate. In 1970, the Detroit School Board tried to ameliorate the city's segregated schools. Four of the six school board members voted for a plan that would bus high school kids from one zone to the other and vice versa to create more racial balance. This led to bomb threats. This is the Pastor Bob the Klanarchist thing that I was talking about earlier. And ultimately, the Michigan State Legislature blocked the plan from going forward. It took a federal judge to nullify the state legislature's actions and allow the high school busing plans to go further. Still, there was a problem with this integration plan. Even with busing, white families who didn't want to integrate could just use the city borders to wall themselves off from black families. In short, they could move. So the NAACP pitched a bold plan to remedy the increase in white flight. It wanted to require white students in the surrounding suburbs to be bused into Detroit, and black children in Detroit to be bused out to the suburbs. This way, it would be much harder for white families to use borders to escape integrated schooling. This plan, which was approved by a federal judge, created a massive uproar and eventually made it to the Supreme Court in the 1974 case Milliken v. Bradley. On one hand, the court found that the city of Detroit was responsible for violating the constitutional rights of black children. But here's the important part. It blocked the inter-district busing plan. The court said that unless the district lines were drawn with racist intent, the suburban districts did not have to integrate among each other or with Detroit. In the majority opinion, Chief Justice Warren Berger just justified the decision by writing about the importance of local control of schools. He wrote that it gave individuals the power to make decisions and cater their schools to fit local needs. So if you wanted to keep your kids away from poor black kids, you could just cross the border to a mostly white suburb. Or you could figure out how to create a new school district and draw the border to wall them out. In his dissent, Justice Thurgood Marshall wrote the following. Quote, "School district lines, however innocently drawn, will surely be perceived as fences to separate the races when, under a Detroit-only decree, white parents withdraw their children from the Detroit City schools and move to the suburbs in order to continue them in all-white schools." End quote. In the past few decades, people of color have started passing through some of those barriers and moving to the suburbs, sometimes in large enough numbers to create what sociologists are calling ethnoburbs. Cute. In response, some white families are moving even farther out into what are called exurbs, or withdrawing from public schools into which they are zoned by using either charter schools or private schools, both of which have helped create more segregated schooling. But many middle-class families don't have the resources to opt out, so if you can't move to the other side of the wall, another option is to put up new ones, to carve out borders with other middle-class families so that you don't need to share with the neediest children, who tend to be more expensive. And for parents trying to do everything to help their kid to get into a better situation, this is an existing roadmap formed by the ridges of judicial and legislative decisions. While Milliken v. Bradley created the legal framework that allows school secession to occur, Sebelia says that it's the structure of school funding that creates the incentive. A huge chunk of school funding comes from local property taxes instead of being a centralized pot of money at the state level. It creates this incentive for homeowners to band together with other better-to-do people, fence in that wealth, and use that money to improve only their schools. That, in turn, could increase their property values. The counterargument is often the Jeffersonian idea of localism, that we function better in smaller communities that people form with like-minded people. But UNC's Wilson says this defense is often used destructively to exclude others. Yeah. And it ignores the discriminatory policies that forced people into certain geographies in the first place. Quote, "Many communities are formed not as a result of voluntary choice, but exclusion," she says. Wilson, who is black, knows firsthand the importance of softening these borders. She grew up in Las Vegas, the most segregated town west of Mississippi, and because the city is under a federal desegregation order, she was able to be bused to a magnet school as a kid. Quote, "If it weren't for being able to escape my school attendance boundary lines," she said, "I do question what would have been my future." Now, back in Gardendale, Alabama, a federal judge oversaw the case of whether the city could create its own district, and she didn't mince words in describing what she saw. Quote, "These citizens prefer a predominantly white city," she wrote, after reviewing the public comments from the organizers. This gave the plaintiffs some hope, despite all the successful secessions from Jefferson County in the past. In the previous school secession cases, the judge didn't go as far as to find racial motives or even dig very far at all. But in this case, the judge said that the organizers' rhetoric communicated to black students that, quote, "These schools are not yours and you are not welcome here." She hit on a theme that was present in all of these fights over borders. This implication that some people inherently belong in this collective group to make decisions, share resources, and add value to the community, and that other people hold them back. Quote, "They certainly believe having the black kids in their schools undermines their kids' education." That's the LSU professor Tyson again. But in her ruling, the judge still allowed Gardendale and its mostly white residents to secede from the Jefferson County District as long as they followed a 3-year desegregation plan. Later, she justified her decision by saying that denying the secession wasn't a, quote, "appropriate way to resolve the dispute." She added, "And isn't it possible that these children and their parents will do more to cure the despicable societal malignancy of racism than an order that drives a wedge in a community and creates new resentments?" End quote. No, probably not. The new Gardendale district had initially planned to launch in the 2017 to 2018 school years with two elementary schools within its borders. But in late May, when the plaintiffs said they would appeal the decision to an appellate court, the judge delayed the formation of the new district. By that point, the Facebook page to organize the secession had grown mostly quiet, but some people were still unhappy that the judge had put conditions on secession in Gardendale. In fact, one man on the Facebook page said that he was glad he had decided to homeschool his daughter. The group's organizer responded, "The less local education becomes, the more sense it will make to people." End quote. And that brings me to homeschooling. Data show that during the high point of school integration in the 80s, 28 of 29 homeschool laws were passed in that decade alone. Homeschooling expanded from expanded by 500% between 1990 and 2000, and pre-pandemic had been growing by 7 to 15% annually. And new studies show conversations about CRT, mask and vaccination regulations, trans and non-binary students, and a rise in alternative education are spiking a new wave of white flight in public education. For example, enrollment of sixth graders in New York dropped by 17.5% from 2021 to 2022. Parents, rather than expose children to diversity or history, are opting to educate them at home. Nationwide studies show a correlation in COVID restriction guidelines and a drop in student enrollment almost exclusively from white suburban students. From 2019 to 2022, private school enrollment rose by almost 2 million. Charter schools rose from 3.5 to 5.5 million, and homeschool students rose from 1.9 million to 4.3 million. Meanwhile, most black students, more than half, remain in crowded, underfunded public schools. And of course, a lot of parents will tell you that fears about things like gun violence are why they're pulling their kids out of school, but the numbers don't bear that out. CRT had a much bigger effect on people wanting to pull their kids out of school than any school shootings have since Columbine. And mass white exodus being triggered by fears about critical race theory is ironic because critical reassessment of the effectiveness of Brown v. Board of Education by Derek Albert Bell Jr. formed the cornerstone of critical race theory. Bell's idea of interest convergence as a means of understanding Western racial history is part of one of the cornerstones of the idea. The idea is that advancement in equal rights only occurs when it converges with white interests. Bell was maybe the only black man in law arguing against Brown v. Board of Education on the grounds that it would similarly force all black institutions to integrate, preventing the establishment of all black institutions and organizations. Bell believed that this was a disservice to black liberation and the broader civil rights movement. See, initially the belief was that integrating schools would improve black education by giving black students access to the same education and materials as white students, but white flight ensured that that wasn't going to happen, and black students continued to have the lowest quality of education available. Bell had worked on the original Brown case, as well as on the Montgomery bus segregation case and 300 other civil rights cases in Mississippi, and he ultimately resigned from Harvard, citing discriminatory policies and a lack of diversity. Protests broke out at the school demanding more diverse curriculum, and it's Harvard, so they got it. Kimberly Crenshaw organized a student-led initiative to offer an alternative course on race and law in 1981 based on Bell's work, and critical race theory developed out of this course. CRT criticizes the legal system's role in generating and legitimizing oppressive social structures, which contributed to maintaining an unjust and oppressive class system. CRT addresses the legal precedents that permit and uphold de facto segregation, which is probably why it scares the fuck out of white people. And something that I think is worth noting, as was referenced by that woman in that article, that the less local education, the more people will understand, that is worrisome, is that at a time whenever truth has sort of become relative and irrespective of facts or information, and people have sort of decided to emotionally embrace pseudoscience and pseudo-history as a means of confirming their weird predilections about lizard people in Atlantis and shit like that, and that Holocaust denial is sort of at like the highest rate that it's been since the 1960s, that people are pulling their children out of school in record numbers and deciding them to teach them at home because they don't rely on education anymore, is worrisome, because there's probably never been a more rapid and easily available source of misinformation as there is at this exact point in human history. So while we can't deny the racist origins of much of America's homeschool system, we also have to look at decentralized education in much the same way we did with, like, the popular health movement and everything, in terms of decentralizing health and removing doctors from the equation. Removing educators from the equation, even though we can acknowledge American schools are typically dog fuck, if your opinion is, well, COVID is just the flu, and my kid's not going to wear a mask because they're easier to kidnap and sell to child traffickers that way, you probably shouldn't be in charge of your child's education, and there should probably be more checks and balances in place to make sure that you're not teaching your kid a whole bunch of tin foil hat ass bullshit. And this was, of course, exacerbated throughout the Trump presidency by the fact that education was overseen by Betsy DeVos, a woman who had never been to a public school and wanted to defund public education for the purposes of handing out private school vouchers to religious institutions to establish religious-based Christian education. So while that was going on, there was no oversight being done whatsoever to what private schools and homeschoolers were teaching their kids. So at probably the height of national fucking crazy, no one cared what people who decided that they didn't want their kids in school were teaching their kids. And it's going to be great whenever we learn what those kids believe whenever they start blowing things up. And, you know, I started this episode out talking about how I had gone to one of the schools that was essentially established in the same form and fashion as these segregation academies, as a white Christian evangelical private institution, until they kicked me out. That I went to one of these schools, and I have to say from personal experience that in much the same way as you know, Jim Brown and Muhammad Ali, I kind of lean toward the idea that forcing black kids into environments that are hostile because they're intended to be white only can be potentially traumatic for the child. That I have a lot of experiences with overt and in some cases violent racism in my childhood because I was put in environments where people did not want me to be there, and in some cases had been expressly created with the intention of keeping people like me out of them. So it's worth mentioning that while the intent of Brown v. Board of Education was to allow black children access to the quality of education that white kids were getting, ultimately, what I think you need, rather than let's teach our kids what the white kids learn, is we need the ability to establish our own schools, our own education. And I think that, you know, I don't often have ideas for solutions on this show. I really think the push needs to be for reparations, for the purposes of establishing black determinism for things like education, medicine, business, and things like that. Because ultimately, the amount of money owed to black people in this country has to be in the trillions at this point. Look at just what they did to black farmers. So I think that what needs to be done is the amount of money that is owed to the black community of the United States of America needs to be given to the black community of the United States of America for us to give ourselves the ability to determine our own quality of education for the first time since we were brought here against our will. And let's be honest, even with the education currently available and the very, very small, less than 10% of African American children who attend private school, we still have some of the highest IQs in under 18s in the world in African American children. So even with the very, 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 very limited amount of time that black kids have had the access of the same quality of education as the average white child, and even that is usually still given at a disparity, they excel. So the white man's concern about literacy back in the 1700s wasn't entirely unfounded. If you give us an inch, we can run 10 miles with that. So with that in mind, when you consider what could be done if we actually had the ability to teach black children as well as white people have been teaching their children, and that's not just, you know, the textbook curriculum shit, I'm talking about ways to succeed in life, to navigate markets, to understand how to invest in their own futures. That's the things that have been deprived, and those are the things that are needed. And I think one of the ways that you achieve that is by not asking white people to help you do it. It is by, yo, you owe us a whole bunch of money, and we're going to take that and be on our way. And I really feel like that's how you solve the black education problem. But that's just me, and you know, what do I know? And that's the episode for today. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you learned something. It's a very, very interesting subject in a lot of ways, because like I said, as a younger person, I was very much one of those people who was, yeah, school integration is a great thing, but when you really look at what it resulted in, it just turned segregation into a thing that you couldn't legally point at and say this is happening. It evolved, you know. White supremacy is a lot like fascism in that way, and that it adapts to its environment. So I think that what we need is the money that is owed to us, so that we can just go on our own and do our own thing. And until that happens, I think that this educational disparity thing is always going to be somewhat of a problem, because why would the guy who wants to control you give you access to all of the tools that he had to put himself in charge? Let's be real. So that's my piece on that. But we'll be back, same Mox time, same Mox channel. On the next episode of the show, we are going to discuss the Night of the Long Knives, sort of an event in the rise of the Nazi Party that I think is extraordinarily relevant to leftist organization in the United States today, because I see a lot of people and a lot of organizations making the same mistakes that the left made in Germany, and I think that it's important to outline those. So I've been planning this episode for, actually, since I was on the Four Cornered Room. So it's been since before Come and See even started, I've been wanting to do an episode that covers the Night of the Long Knives. And on the next episode of the show, we're finally going to get that done. So that's what we have coming at you next. Until then, though, concentrate on the HEP, everybody. I have been Moxie O'Brien. This has been Come and See. And I will catch all of you beautiful people on the flip side. Smooches, deuces, dig it.
I'm finished.